My favorite thing about Bill Mitchell and When Dating Hurts podcast is the opportunity to share my voice and my story. I think that no matter where you are in listening about someone else's situation or sharing your own, that being within a community of listeners where it's safe to share a voice is invaluable. Thank you, Bill.
The When Dating Hurts podcast continues to grow in popularity. The more who listen, the more who will know the realities of dating and domestic violence. In the meantime, the When Dating Hurts book, in paperback, ebook, and audiobook, is being purchased and read by concerned parents, teachers, victims and survivors, and of course, those who are currently dating. Education leads to empowerment. That way, if a potential abuser is targeting you or someone you care about, you will know how to detect it and how to break free and stay safe. Up next, another survivor story to illustrate how an innocent person can become manipulated and trapped in abusive relationships. This interview with Lee Ann, who lives in Florida, covers a lot of topics. You'll hear about overt narcissism, emotional and physical violence, love bombing, and the rise and fall of fortunes made and fortunes lost. Leanne has seen it all and experienced it all, from living in a manor house with a housekeeper to living on the run after calling in police to break up a domestic dispute. You will also hear about the death of two ex-husbands. And through it all, Leanne was a determined survivor who found strength and continues to recover. This is Leanne's story, part one of two parts. Today we're speaking with Leanne, who's going to take us through a very troubling story. It matches up with a lot of these because things seem to be the right way to go with this man that we'll speak about, meaning that he seemed to be the right person at the right time. And of course, Leanne wouldn't be a survivor of domestic violence if it had gone well. Leanne, welcome to the When Dating Hurts podcast. It's great to have you on here, and you're being very generous telling your story today, so welcome.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to kind of turn the pages back, before your first marriage, what was growing up like? What would you like to tell us?
I'm of Generation X, so I'm a little older. I grew up right outside of D.C. with a mother and a father and a younger brother. Both of my parents were professionals, absolutely entrenched in their occupations.
So what you're saying is they were so much into what they were doing for a living or whatever was taking their attention away, there wasn't a lot left for Leanne.
No, there really, really wasn't. And my younger brother is extremely bipolar to the point where it's debilitated his life. I noticed it around the age of 12. I'm 2 years older than he is. And my mother, just like I am, I'm a registered nurse. My mother was also a registered nurse. My father was in the media. I tried to convey that there was something going on with my brother, but I think there was a lot of denial. And my parents are still with us, and they are a formidable force. They've known each other since they were 15 and 17. They're both college educated. They finished college, got married, still very happily married, but they sort of operate as one unit. So I didn't have a confidant in one versus the other.
That's really a force. So if you had problems, you were going up against a real brick wall with those two.
I was, and it's not to say they aren't fantastic people. They're wonderful people. They just came from a different age. My dad is from the silent generation. My mother's a baby boomer. Very much into values, into the way things should be.
So if you needed attention with something growing up, do you think it was that they thought, well, nobody helped me when I was younger and you need to figure that out on your own? Is that what you're saying?
I would say yes. And I would also say that feelings were heavily discouraged. If I had a problem at school or something tragic had happened and I would become emotive, you know, perhaps cry or whatever, I was immediately told to dry it up and not allowed to actually have feelings, which has made me the thinker that I am today. And it's probably my own children's biggest complaint about me. So I think that was a little bit of conditioning. And maybe what also led me to making the choices that I made, because I make most of my decisions based on thinking. Feeling is not my first response.
At some point in time in high school or college, I would stick my neck out and say you were dating.
I never, ever had any serious relationships in high school.
They just didn't happen, or you just didn't want them?
I just didn't want them. I was busy having fun with my friends.
I mean, they weren't necessary?
No, they weren't necessary. I went to a prestigious all-girls private Catholic high school. I was just with my friends.
And that was in the D.C. area too?
No, actually, that was down in Hollywood, Florida.
Good Catholic girl.
I'm a cashew. I have a Jewish parent and a Catholic parent. I tended to get in trouble in the district schools here, so I was not invited to come back. So my parents had no choice but to send me to private school. And that just happened to be the option that I thought would be best for me. I think my parents' expectation was I was going to go to college. And I had one in mind, and that was my father's alma mater, which was Penn State. I had a lot of respect for my father. I wanted to see something new. He reminisced often about his education there, and I wanted to go, and I got in. It was excitement. We did all the paperwork. He got my dorm room. Everything was prepared. We were only a couple weeks out before I went there. And I got a knock on my bedroom door one evening, and he came and sat down and he said, Leanne, we can't do it. The out-of-state tuition, there's just no way. We're going to be jeopardizing our retirement. My other option, the other school that I did get into, was FSU. And he said, let's just do FSU. You can't tell an 18-year-old who was already so mentally prepared and maybe a little selfish. I did call FSU. They said, sure, we'll still accept you, but now you have to wait another semester before you begin because it's too close. And at that point, I was in a rush. I was immature, obviously. I'm 18 years old, and I'm like, if I don't go to college now, who knows what I'm going to do? I wasn't the best behaved child. Let's just put it that way. Hence me ending up in private school. So as luck would have it, my best friend at the time called me the next day and she said, Leanne, I didn't get into any college and I don't know what I'm going to do. And I'm thinking about joining the Marine Corps. And she said, I would really appreciate it if you came along with me for moral support. And I said, sure.
Do you mean join also?
No. She didn't want to go by herself. So she had a second set of ears to see what they were offering. So I suggested to her, I think, well, if you're really interested in the Marine Corps, I think it would behoove you to check out the other services also. And they were all in the same area. So see what each branch has to offer in terms of what you want. We visited the Marine Corps first. I think we visited Army second. And I grew up on the Chesapeake Bay. My father always had a boat. So every weekend we would go sailing on the Chesapeake Bay. And of course, that's where the Naval Academy is. And they always impressed me so much. And they actually gave me a very good spiel. And I really wanted to go into journalism, which was a very small sector of the Navy at that time. They would only accept, I believe, 300 plus enlisted per year. So I took the ASVAB and passed with flying colors. And they said, if you want to do journalism, I believe we can offer it to you. So I went home, sat my parents down, and told them, I joined the Navy. I don't know if I'm allowed to curse or not. I won't. Don't try. I'll try very hard not to. I'm an ex-sailor, by the way.
I encourage it.
Okay. I just said, fuck you. I joined the Navy. There you go. You couldn't send me where I wanted to go. And in my spoiled little entitled way, you couldn't send me where I wanted to go. I joined the Navy. My mother immediately burst into tears. She said, no, we spent all this money on your education. You're expected to go to college. And I said, no, I think this will work. I said, I get to get out of this house. I get to go travel. I get an education of something I'd like to do anyway. I was going to go into college for journalism and communications. And I think this would be a good option for me. And my best friend ended up joining also, but she joined reserve. And I joined active. So the opposite actually happened.
That's a far cry from Marines.
She got on my father and she said, you march right back down there with Leanne and you tell them she is to whatever, undo the paperwork that I had signed. So my father, in one of his better moments, took me back to the recruiter and said, what is this? How did you manipulate my daughter into joining the armed services? And they were really good talking to him, very good communicators. And they explained the program. They explained what was going to happen. They were telling him about the GI Bill. They were doing this, doing all the things. And he looked at the recruiter and then he looked at me and he said, do you really want to do this? And I said, yeah, Dad, why not? And he says, okay, I'll support you. I'll take care of your mom and I'll support you.
Gee, wow. So, never saw that coming.
Nope. So into the Navy I went and I did end up going to journalism school. I ended up being stationed first in San Diego on a ship where I did 2 deployments. I served in Desert Storm.
Oh.
And I happened to meet my first husband while serving. Wonderful, wonderful man. So I eventually got out because it was my time to get out, but he intended on making it a career.
Well, you did what, 4 years?
Mm-hmm. I did.
Was he also enlisted? Was he officer?
He was enlisted. He was a petty officer. He was a couple ranks above me, and he was just a gregarious, goofy guy that did a really good job and had an impeccable reputation as a sailor. I met a lot of people who knew him throughout the years and had nothing but positive to say about him. Went home and I prepared a wedding. He asked me to marry him. I am 22 years old. I think that was my first mistake. I should have gone to college is what I should have done. But I try not to use the word should. I've learned that. It's a very big lesson in life. Should implies judgment. You can use a term like prefer. It probably would have been a better option. Let's just put it that way, had I gone to college. But no, I got married. And almost right away, I got pregnant. And shortly thereafter, I had another child. And then I realized, okay, he's enlisted Navy. This is not going to last forever. I don't think I was meant to be a stay-at-home mom full-time. And I would really like an education. And he actually helped me do that. He really did. He was fantastic. So I used the GI Bill. I had his full support. He got us orders to a place called, if you've heard of it, Lakehurst, New Jersey, where the Hindenburg went down. So we were right off that airfield. He worked right across the street from where we lived in Navy housing. And I was able to go to a community college there and at least get my associates while we were in New Jersey. And then we got new orders to Florida, and I ended up going to a state school here and getting my bachelor's. I chose nursing, A, because I learned a lot from my mother when she came home from work, believe it or not. You pick up a lot when you hear the stories. And I also thought it would be a good choice having a husband who is going to be deployed often. And at this point, we had 2 kids, 2 young ones at home. And when he was gone, at least I can somehow maneuver my schedule to accommodate them. I'd feel better. I'd generate income and contribute. So that's what happened.
One of the great things I understand about being a nurse is you can take it with you.
Yes.
If he gets moved to another place, you can take it with you and walk in and just kind of pick it up where you left off, I guess.
Right. 2 weeks before I graduated nursing school, I gave birth to our third child, and I got a job almost right away. And at this point now, we're in the final lap of his Navy career, of his 20 years. And I started noticing subtle changes in his behavior, whereas he used to be fastidious and clean, and he would take wonderful care of the children, made sure they were bathed, fed. I would work, at that time, they were doing 8-hour shifts, and I would pick up doubles. So I would work 16, and I would come home, and I would find the house in disarray. I would find the children's diapers hadn't been changed. I didn't know if they'd eaten. And I just started probing. I'm like, what's going on? And, you know, this is happening. And now we're looking at your retirement coming right down the pike. You know, for me, 2-3 years isn't a long period of time. It goes like that. You need to have some sort of a preparation. You need to have a plan. You're a young man. He joined when he was 17. So he was retiring at 37. And he wasn't interested in going to school, but he was very gifted with his hands. He could build anything, fix anything, and I encouraged him. Nothing seemed to be working, and I just couldn't figure out what was going on with this man. So then there would be times I would come home exhausted from 16 hours, and I'd find, back then, this is right before cell phones, the phone was cut off, the landline was cut off. Sometimes I came home and the power was out. And I'm like, I'm making enough money. Oh, that's my first mistake, by the way. I think back, and we didn't teach our girls to manage money as well as probably we should have, you know, to be involved and to know all the inner workings of running a household financially. I left that in his hands. The only times I took over was when he was deployed. And when he came back, I had everything fixed and then he'd blow it. So I was done, and we had a come to Jesus meeting, and I said, listen, I want to be separated. You either need to go to therapy, figure out what's going on with you, but I have 3 little mouths that I have to feed. And at this point, they were 9, 3, and 1. So we separate, and I'm on the computer, and I'm just messing around with the computer back when Yahoo chat rooms were a thing. And I get this private message. And it said, how would you like, I'll never forget it. How would you like to have an affair? So I started talking to this person. Turns out he was local to me. He was very open about who he was, told me his name, told me what he did, that he was a licensed mental health therapist. We just started chatting and we got along swimmingly. I mean, it was an easy conversation. It felt good. It was finally a friend. I was working all the time. I didn't have time to socialize with other people. And again, like I said, I'm introverted. It's much easier for me. So then we met. And when we met, I was agog. I just completely fell for him. My first husband continued his downward spiral. I said I want a divorce. And I think very shortly thereafter, I actually told him, I'm seeing somebody else. We're done. He says, oh, let's try to fix it. Let's try to fix it. And I'm like, I've asked you for the past 1.5 years. Let's try to fix this. Nothing's happening. There's no movement on your part. I'm 31 at this point, and I'm like, I have a future and I have children that I have to consider. So Bob was fantastic. And here's where the narcissism comes in. Here's the first thing I had no idea about. Here come the flowers. The jewelry, the gifts. He would deliver food, good food, high-end food from high-end restaurants to my place of work. All of the things. I'm feeling so special. I'm feeling amazing. Everything's great. We're headed towards divorce. He's helping me out with that. We go to divorce. My ex, as badly as everything was going, he wasn't an awful man. He was making the same amount of money I was. I just wanted it done. I wanted it over with. We split 50-50 everything. I didn't require child support unless he was deployed. And then I made probably one of the first mistakes, and I moved in with Bob.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I can no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get $6,000 cash, give us each $3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com or wherever fine podcasts are found.
Did you ever figure out why your first husband spiraled like he did?
That would be answered by his death. And I made the same mistake twice by being oblivious. Turns out, I learned this later from the daughter who could talk, the oldest daughter. He passed away. My children were 10, 7, and 4 at that point with him. I ended up having a child with Bob. It wasn't a child I chose. And I think I mentioned in what I wrote you, I think that he poked a hole in the condom. I think it was on purpose. I definitely do. I was very careful. It was not an opportune time to have a child. I'd already had 3. He had 1 from a previous marriage.
But he wanted to lock you up somehow. Yes.
I think, yeah, that's exactly what I think. Oh, he did better than that as time goes. Yeah, as we progress.
I was going to say there's nothing like a child to be a real pair of handcuffs to someone for the rest of your life, potentially.
When we talk about gaslighting, I held the condom up and I showed him. And it was obvious. And after that particular night, he always denied it. Always denied it. Said, that never happened. I don't recall this condom you showed me. That never happened.
Oh.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
I'm surprised he didn't come back with something like, well, I guess it tore a hole in it. What can I tell you?
No, he wasn't that smart.
He's obviously a very smart guy, but he just didn't think of that, is what you're saying.
No, he didn't.
But like you said, you know, what happened is that rather than deal with it, it's like it didn't happen. I don't know what you're talking about.
It just didn't happen. Poof. I made it go away.
It's back on you. It's like, you know, your head created a memory that's based upon nothing.
Right, right. So my first husband and I ended up having an amicable divorce. And it was. Bob and my first husband got along very well. In fact, when Bob and I actually bought our own home, he came in and put all the fixtures and fixed it up.
Jeez, that's unexpected.
He wanted things to be nice for his daughters.
That takes a big person.
That's the kind of person he was. I think he was depressed. And so the story about his demise is a very sad one. He asked me, I would like to take the older 2 daughters camping. He had a fellow shipmate that had 2 daughters the same age. And he said, I'd like to take them camping. Is that okay? I said, absolutely. I think the kids would have a great time. There's a lake there. And he said, oh, and listen, I got a brand new cell phone. And this was back in the day where it took like a whole day to charge up. Remember the old cell phones? And to charge it up, and almost like had to be on the charger for hours and hours, right?
They were the size of a shoe back then.
So he said, if you can't get a hold of me, I don't want you to worry. It's just that the phone's charging. I didn't think anything of it. So I took our youngest daughter and the daughter I had with Bob. We all went to the beach and had a wonderful day. Came back from the beach and my landline was blowing up with messages. And one was from the man that he went camping with. He said, Leanne, I can't find him. I don't know where he is. So immediately I'm panicking because I still have love for this man, right? I think even at this point, honestly, Bill, I think even at this point, I was hoping we could salvage that marriage, or what was the marriage, because he really was such a wonderful, wonderful guy. And I wanted to get down into what was bugging him. So finally, you know, I'm a mess. He went camping on an army site. I'm calling the army. I'm calling his command at the Navy command. I'm calling the state troopers. Meanwhile, Bob gets in the car and he drives to the campsite, which is an hour away, to go get the kids. And at this point, he told me later, it was on his way to pick up the kids that the state troopers called him and told him that they had retrieved my first husband's body from the lake. It was horrific. It's a grief. And this happened back in 2004. And it's a grief that took me a good 15 years to finally get to acceptance and not keep meandering around all the different stages of grief. I finally got to acceptance. I talk to him every day still. And it'll be 20 years this year he's gone from my life. But he'll never leave. Yes. So I think he was, his blood alcohol level was very high. And I believe he was an alcoholic. And it was then that my oldest daughter would tell me that she would see him drinking a lot. She never told me that before, but she was 10. She didn't know what she was seeing. She saw other people around him, friends drinking, but she would tell me he would continue to drink even alone. And I think he was depressed. You know, I could speculate that maybe the idea of getting out of the Navy and what is he going to do next? And, you know, he was at the forge in the road, and maybe he just didn't know. I don't know. Maybe he was suffering from some kind of depression. But he was an alcoholic, and I didn't recognize it. Had no idea. So that was an awful day, because I had to tell my three kids. The four-year-old, of course, didn't understand, but the oldest two definitely did. Around this time, Bob and I had gotten into an argument. It's probably shortly before we moved in this particular house. That should have been my first warning. He got upset with me over, I don't even remember what it was about. Now, he was 6'5", about 235 at his healthiest. He was an accomplished athlete as well as a psychotherapist. I'm 5'4", 135 on my heaviest day, but he threw me across the room. Absolutely just picked me up like I was nothing, threw me across the room, threw me onto the bed. I wasn't necessarily hurt. I got a little whiplash. He was angry. I'm thinking, what do women do? We blame ourselves. Oh, I asked for that. I said the wrong thing. I could have done this better. I could have handled this altercation better. I actually made myself believe that. Because I'd never witnessed abuse, not in my own home growing up, not with my friends growing up, not with any of my relatives. It was always a stranger to me. I was fortunate enough, even when, you know, the various guys that I had dated along the way, no one's ever put a hand on me. So this was a shocker. And I let it go. And that was probably the biggest mistake I ever made. But life goes on.
Well, isn't it one of those things too, when that happens, like you kind of, I think, hinted about, the only way you could make sense of it was that somehow you caused it to happen. So it wouldn't have happened if you hadn't said or done whatever you did. And maybe the path forward is you just have to be more careful about what you say or do. So you don't wind up in that same spot.
Right. And here's a funny dichotomy with what I was telling you about my dad. When that happened, my first instinct was to cry, and I dried it up and I wanted to protest, and I stopped that too, because that's what I had been taught. So it works both ways. And I found out later as our, and we did end up getting married, but as our relationship progressed and the abuse became worse, and sometimes things got very real and I did cry, oh, that gave him so much ammunition to make it worse. I couldn't show those emotions.
How does that work? Why would that make him go at it even more?
Oh, get over it, Leanne. Look at you. You look at you making this into something that it's not. Come on. Look at you. Always the drama queen. You're always a problem. You're just such a crybaby. I got that a lot.
So he had the one instance where he picked you up and threw you.
Right.
What else did he do?
Okay, we had a major hurricane come through and it ripped off part of our roof. And we had just purchased this home like 10 months earlier, got the roof fixed. I'm like, let's just sell the house. Let's get something new. The market was really, this is before the bust. We ended up selling the house for great profit. We moved to where he wanted to move. I didn't have a say so. In fact, he chose the house. I didn't have a say so. Mm-hmm. We moved to where he wanted. Life for a while was nice. And then he said, I think it's a good idea that you don't work anymore. We had four little ones at home. The cost of childcare alone, helping the kids with their homework, you know, taking care. It was a large house, taking care of the house. I said, okay, I'll take a break. I'll take a break. I'll stay home with the kids for a while. It's financially, it made sense. And so that's what I did. But I realized what he was doing. He was isolating me. I mean, when I look back and categorically, just the whole line of events from when we met to the progression, I saw what was happening, right? So I tried to make friends, but he had to drive me to where I was going to meet a friend or a group of friends and then pick me up and take me home. He had to.
But you had a car, but he had to drive you.
We both had a car. Yeah, but he had to drive me.
That's what I mean. And so at the moment, didn't you think that was strange or do you think, gee, what a great guy?
No, and enter gaslighting again. I know you don't like to drive at night. What if you have something to drink? And, you know, I would feel safer if I picked you up and took you home.
I could see that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Sure. All right. Sounds okay.
Then the alcohol began. I'd wake up in the morning and you know what a Greyhound is, a vodka and a grapefruit juice. By now, I'm well into my 30s. I'd like an occasional glass of wine. If I went out with friends, I would socially drink. It was never something that I did at home. Maybe a glass of wine with dinner. It wasn't any of those things. But he would make me drinks throughout the day and then announce to the children, oh, I've got to go out and get your mother more hooch. She's had all the hooch. She drank it all last night. And I'm looking at the bottle and I'm like, okay, how did I drink all of that last night? How does that even make sense? But somehow he convinced me that I had all of that. So then something occurred to me, but I wasn't quite sure because he liked to socially drink also. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to switch to wine. I know he doesn't like wine. Let's see if there's a difference. And there was.
The bottle didn't go down as fast?
No, it didn't. That was my first suspicion. Then the economy blew up and that was the end of us. We had had several properties. We lost those. We had a lot of stocks and bonds. We lost those. And our suddenly comfortable lifestyle became untenable. And he wasn't doing anything about it. And he still forbid me to go to work at this point. So we're just motoring along. And he took a second job. And we're trying to hold things together.
What was his second job? What did he take on?
Oh, he was working privately. He was working privately. And then the horror happened. The horror happened.
Oh.
He didn't look at me like a person. He looked at me like an object. I was an enhancement. He would purposely send me out with men dressed to the nines because it made him feel powerful.
He sent you out with men?
He sent me out with men. Friends. I don't think a lot of husbands would be very comfortable. You know, I could see maybe getting together as a couple. I mean, to me personally, if you're in a trusting relationship, if you happen to have a male female kind of relationship and you all are friends or whatever, that's fine on a casual basis. But no, he would get me dressed up. It would be a big deal. He would be making suggestions about where we'd go to dinner. And he had no problem with that. He liked to show me off. He got off on some weird way by doing that. That's where the next step comes in.
Like really working the trophy wife thing.
Yes. He changed my hair. He changed the way I did my makeup. My wardrobe changed. My shoes changed. Half of my wardrobe was lingerie. I wasn't allowed to go to bed without wearing lingerie, which is not the most comfortable to sleep in.
But also like plastic surgery?
Yes. He had me completely remodeled. Yep.
How'd you feel about that? I mean, that's at that time, what are you thinking? Are you thinking I'm going to improve my looks? Or are you looking at it like I don't want to do this, but I guess I don't want him to be unhappy with me and here I go? I mean, what's going on in your head?
I don't want him to be unhappy with me. I want him to find me attractive, you know.
This concludes Leanne's story, part one. Be looking for part two on the When Dating Hurts podcast. Thank you for listening to the When Dating Hurts podcast. We have been steadily moving up in podcast review rankings based on downloads in the relationships category. That means more and more listeners are getting the kind of advice that can improve lives for victims, survivors, and their families. If you feel we need to hear your story, do not hesitate to email me at BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. That's BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. Hi, it's Bill Mitchell. I'm proud to say the When Dating Hurts podcast is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. To learn more about Evergreen Podcasts or to check out other shows on the Evergreen Network, just visit evergreenpodcasts.com.